Welcome, Reg readers. I'm U.S. editor Cade Metz, and here, back by popular demand on Reg Radio, is Overstock.com CEO Patrick Byrne. Welcome, Patrick.
Cade, great to be back.
Really appreciate you being here. Life is never dull, it seems, for you. I thought maybe we could start by talking about the recent news from your Q3 earnings call. About your ERP system. Evidently, the ERP system wasn't quite working for the past 5.5 years. Is this correct?
Well, no. The ERP system got shoveled into place in 2005, and we've had a restatement. There actually is a smaller restatement going that actually does go back 5.5 years, but the bulk of it was from 05 to 08. And basically, people who've been following Overstock know that in 05, we just switched from sort of homegrown, my gosh, our whole computer system would have easily fit under this desk, to we went and we grew from 2 million to 800 million over, you know, in a few 4 or 5 years. And we just went out in 05 and upgraded, forklift upgrades to big enterprise class systems. And it was a real mess. We almost got killed from it. And 05, 06, 07, we cleaned it up. We thought we had everything cleaned up, but what the accountants discovered in the last month was some bad bookkeeping on their part. So we had to do a restatement. We've now had one restatement up for $4 million and one restatement down for $12 million over two different periods.
Okay.
So it wasn't – I'm sorry. I started getting phone calls from Oracle saying, oh, you know, people are calling us. It wasn't Oracle's fault. We went out and did this 18-month upgrade in about 6 months, and we basically – it was a heart and lung transplant, and it turns out we didn't connect some of the arteries as quite as we should have connected them.
So ERP woes aside, how are things looking for the company amidst the economic meltdown?
Well, things were, I'd say, looking great. We were at the point – we grew 27% in the first half of the year, and we've gotten to the point where we're spitting off – very solid positive cash flow, and I expected to make a good bit of gap income this quarter and from then on. Something has clearly happened. I'm sure you're, you know, hearing about it in retail. We've compressed very over a couple months from 27% growth to basically, I've already said publicly, we ended October flat, within a percent of flat. We see what's going on elsewhere in online retail. And we see people being down 15 to 30%, which we see as a stunning amount. I think we'll be okay this quarter. I think we'll actually end up having, you know, I've said publicly, if we just get to 0 to 5% growth for this quarter, if we can end the quarter with that, I'll be thrilled while the rest of the world is just collapsing.
Got it, got it. So in the past, you talked about Overstock maybe being in a better position to handle recessions than other companies. Do you still see it that way? Is that true of this particular situation?
Well, we're at least beta friendly, which would mean in periods of high volatility, we'll do better than otherwise. In a perfectly steady state world, there is an excess inventory. In supply chain theory, they say buffer or suffer. When you have uncertainty equals inventory. It's another way to put it, that you have to buffer your uncertainty. Well, in a perfectly steady state world, everyone would know exactly what to make and what was going to sell. Well, so there is an excess inventory. In either very good times or bad times is when there's a lot of excess inventory. In our case, so we've always thought we're beta friendly, and we tend to be countercyclical in the sense of when there is a sharp downturn, that's when people call us, that's when we get all these deals. That's in the past, it's been good for us when there's been a sharp downturn. But of course, nothing has prepared anyone for what's going on right now. We are getting a tremendous amount of calls. It's great on the supply side. We've never had as easy a time as we're now having picking up excess inventory. The problem is consumer.
Right. I mean, you still got to have people buying the stuff, right?
Right. And up to a certain point of downturn, these things compensate for each other. But at this point, you know, what's really happening is in normal times, the middle class does not discount shop. It's the lower income and more affluent people. If you go to a Costco on a Saturday morning, you see in the parking lot, you see Mercedes-Benzes and you see Junkers. It's really striking. And there's some very good research that from South Carolina, actually, that shows the middle class pays full retail. They want to go to Nordstrom. They want to pay full price. In a downturn is when they shift to discount shopping. So that's A, why you're seeing the middle class tier of retailers are the ones who are folding up now. And you just see stores closing after store closing. But so you would think this might help us because suddenly a lot of people are switching to discount shopping. But the truth is this contraction in consumer spending is so sudden, I don't think it's helping any – no retailers picking up from it except maybe Walmart. Maybe there's a bit of a shift to Walmart.
And how bad is this going to get in your mind?
I think, unfortunately, you know, I'm a Debbie Downer about this, but I think that we're just a couple or a few innings into what's to come. I think that this is the deleveraging of a civilization, that we have the housing bubble created a bubble in just consumer spending, and as that housing bubble is popped, it's going to take a whole layer of froth out of our real economy. I think. Sorry to be a downer.
No, that's what I expected you to say. In your mind, the housing bubble was the main cause of this, and other causes would be?
Well, I think of it like those carnival games where there's a pyramid of milk bottles stacked and you throw the baseball at the milk bottles. The baseball in this case was the subprime mess, but the conditions, the stack of milk bottles waiting, you know, turned out to be stacked much higher and more fragilely than anyone knew, and that's really just different kinds of derivative risk that had built up in the system in ways that were way beyond what people were expecting and was thinking was the case. One class of that risk is this fight that I've been in, naked short selling. But anyway, the proximate cause is the subprime mess. But what it has exposed is a tremendous amount more leverage and derivative risk scattered throughout the system than people were anticipating.
We'll get back to naked short selling naturally. But before we do that, I mean, who do you see as well-positioned to endure this? Is there anyone, on the technology side, on the web side?
Well, Google is – I do think Google is recession-proof because – so much of the economy is really search costs, and the more – and Google, of course, strips all the search costs out of the equation. And so I think the tighter times are, the better and better Google looks. I do think it's – you know, it may not grow at – what has it been growing, 30 or 40% still last I checked? It's
31% in Q3.
I don't think that continues in a sharp downturn, but I think it is not it's going to be a cash machine for the foreseeable future.
Well, there are other search engines out there. Yahoo's a search engine, and their profits are dipping pretty fast. What's the difference there?
Well, one, frankly, I don't want to offend anybody at Yahoo, but just the quality of the searches at Google,
right,
I think, are better. And, you know, it's, I think, 65% market share for Google, somewhere in the teens,
right,
for Yahoo.
Is it quality at this point, or is it just mind share?
Well, it's clearly Google has become synonymous with search like Xerox did with copying. But I thought that Microsoft has dramatically improved the quality of its search results, and they may have a chance. But, boy, Google has occupied such the high ground. I don't see how Microsoft or anyone is really going to give them a run for their money.
Would you call it a monopoly at this point?
No, I wouldn't say it's a monopoly. It isn't. Remember, when I was a kid, the DOJ was trying to bust up IBM because it was a monopoly, and then they made, you know, one or two wrong turns, and Microsoft emerged. And then not 10 years ago, the DOJ was trying to bust up Microsoft. And Microsoft said, look, Gates used to say, it's only going to take one bad decision, and we'll lose it all. And people scoffed at that. Well, he almost missed the internet. They did miss search. Now Google has it. I think their point is they want it to be known that they're not a one-trick pony, and they've organized their company so they'll be agile and not see the same thing happen to them as happened to Microsoft or IBM. But it's hard to see someone coming along and dislodging Google. But on the other hand, I just heard about some folks who left Google and got $30 million of venture capital about 4 or 5 months ago, and they've started a competitor. They're building a competitor.
Cool, you mean?
Is that their?
Well, Cool was started by a group of ex-Googlers launched in the summer. Mixed reviews. I think at this point, you can't challenge Google's dominance in terms of search. There might be another technology that comes along and replaces search as the dominant technology. I mean, that's what happened with IBM. That's what has happened with Microsoft, in a sense, is that you have someone coming into a new market and displacing you. I don't see anyone displacing Google head-to-head on search. I mean, even if you have – you know, there was so much talk about a Yahoo-Microsoft merger and what that would mean for Google. It wouldn't mean anything for Google. Mm-hmm. You know, even if those two companies come together, even if they're able to merge their companies well, I don't think they can eat into Google's market share there.
And Google is leveraging it so intelligently with, for example, Google Apps. I mean, it really costs us, I think, about $600 in Microsoft fees for every person we have in the company on Microsoft Office and Windows and such. And, you know, Google, you can save yourself that cost. Now, we don't, because we don't want Google being able to read all our internal documents and everything. But other people, if I were in the brick-making business, I probably wouldn't care about that. So Google is leveraging the search so well. So even if somebody does spring up to challenge on some other front, it's hard to see Google not doing what Microsoft did, was that they just leveraged their operating system so that when somebody came along with a good, you know, bookkeeping platform program, Microsoft either tried to buy them, or if they couldn't buy them, they just created their own version. And I can just see Google doing that for a long time.
So Google perhaps recession-proof. Anyone else? Or they stand alone?
Google stands alone. Google stands alone that way.
Getting back to the economy as a whole, and we'll go ahead and jump to the naked shorting thing. For those who don't realize, you've been on what amounts to a personal crusade against naked shorting for more than 3 years now, right?
Right. Going on four.
Can you explain the basics briefly for those who?
Very, very easily. Yeah, it's and without jargon. It's really this – it's so much simpler than people even get, I think, because they hear the jargon. And that is, if you buy stock from me, you give me your money and I give you stock, and that's called settlement. Believe it or not, there are loopholes in the system that allow me, not if as a private individual, but if I'm a large prime broker, if I'm a certain hedge fund, I could essentially just take your money and not give you the stock, just give you an IOU for the stock that you bought. Now, you'd never know that. You'd get your E-Trade statement that says you got this stock, and you never knew that I never actually delivered. I failed to deliver, and it's called an FTD. Well, it turns out that billions of these IOUs, these FTDs, built up in the system over time. And the loopholes were created for good intent, maybe, in the settlement system, because it just gave a bit of fault tolerance, which your listeners will understand. It was like a tech system with some fault tolerance. So if somebody signed the wrong form or made a little mistake on the paperwork, the system wouldn't just seize up. The stock would keep trading and so forth. But what happened is some hedge funds figured out over the last decade, at least, how they could exploit these loopholes to take companies down and destabilize the system.
So in essence, what they're doing is they're short selling shares they don't have, kind of creating counterfeit shares in the system.
Yeah, one of the ways of doing this involves looking like you're short selling, but then you just don't do what a short seller does, which is you borrow and then resell the stock. You skip the borrowing and you just sell. And so one could ask, well, what is it you're selling? To which I would say, exactly. They're just selling – they end up just really selling these IOUs. So really – short selling and naked short selling is just one approach to this, but the real issue isn't, I don't even like the term naked short selling because it kind of is, because then the people who are not against this come back and say, oh no, short selling is fine, short selling is good. I keep pointing out sexual harassment is not a type of sex. A sea lion is not a type of lion. Naked short selling isn't a type of short selling. It's a way of manipulating these loopholes. And it's really just one of several ways of manipulating the loophole. So I, in general, speak less about naked short selling and more in terms of just problems in the settlement system.
And for those 3 going on 4 years, you were largely ignored in your efforts to sort of bring attention to this.
On a good day, I was ignored.
On a good day.
Most days, I was vilified.
But I think that you felt, at least on a certain level, you were vindicated this summer as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage brokerage companies, were struggling to stay afloat. The SEC ended up banning naked shorting in 19 stocks, including Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Right.
Did you feel completely vindicated, partially vindicated?
You know, well, certainly partially. It's funny. I don't approach it in terms of my own vindication. I hate to sound, I don't know, maybe it sounds cocky. I knew I was right. I always knew I was right. The data was there that this was going on. The data was there. The people were there who I found and explained it to me, and people who were involved in different. So I really didn't have, I think vindication is something that comes when you don't know if you're right or wrong. I was highly confident that this was in fact going on. I actually feel like I've taken a bat to my solar plexus. Because the other aspect of this, one aspect of this naked shorting and these settlement problems is that you can use it to destroy companies. And typically the companies that come under this kind of attack are tech companies, which is why I've always been curious why people in Silicon Valley didn't sort of sink their teeth into this earlier on. This has been absolutely pernicious for American tech entrepreneurship. The bigger problem, though, and the thing that kept me awake at nights was this understanding that that we had a locomotive bearing down on our nation's economy, and if we didn't divert it, if we didn't fix this, it could, you know, we could have, I used to say, something that makes 1929 look like a Tea Party. So when that's since this summer, when the SEC, about 3 years ago, the SEC went from saying, denying this existed, to saying, okay, well, it exists, but we're doing something about it, and then doing very, very little. And then this summer, when they came out and said that crime that we were saying isn't going on, we now have to draw an emergency, we have to sort of create an emergency shelter for 19 companies at the heart of our financial system, or else the whole thing will melt down. I guess you could say that when I wasn't, I did feel some sense of vindication. Yeah. It wasn't my first priority, though.
So what you're saying here is that, you know, as you said before, the main cause of this economic meltdown is the subprime mortgage crisis. But as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were struggling, your contention here is that and I don't think sure. Commissioner Cox at the SEC would necessarily agree with this, but your contention is that as they were struggling to stay afloat, then these hedge funds started to naked short sell them and in effect make things worse.
Yes. I wouldn't even say the subprime problem is the main problem. I would just say it's the proximate problem. It's the proximate cause. It's the trigger that has triggered this. But then the collapse is continuing and is going to go so deep because of all kinds of derivative risk that is built into the system. And clearly, as some companies became vulnerable, the financial companies, they clearly were naked shorted to high heaven and taken out. Now, maybe they would have gone bankrupt anyway, maybe they wouldn't have, but they couldn't access the capital market at their true market clearing price because there were millions and then tens of millions of shares being sold that weren't being settled. And those companies, of course, what's ironic is the CEOs of those companies have come out and said, oh, my God, we were naked. You know, the guy, Dick Fuld, who ran Lehman Brothers, said we were naked shorted. And that's – these were the guys who were enabled.
Lehman Brothers also part of that 19
yeah,
company
Lehman
order.
Brothers.
Merrill Lynch.
Merrill, Goldman, Morgan, Bear was already gone by the end of March. But these were the companies who've been enabling this to happen to everybody else at the same time they denied it was actually going on. And it's only when it happened to them that they ran to the government and DC gave them sort of emergency protection against the crime that 3 years ago they denied existed.
You've called this Kafkaesque now.
Yeah. Well, you know there's many Kafkaesque aspects to this story.
The situation was is the SEC put down the order, mm-hmm. And it was later lifted before Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac ended up being seized by the government, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Regardless, I mean, many have still said and continue to say that naked shorting, if it even had an effect, was just a small effect on the eventual outcome.
Well, they're nuts. If my answer to that is, first of all, remember when the SEC was saying in 03, 04, the same kind of stuff. This is small. It isn't going on. Don't worry about it. When they passed a regulation against it called Regulation Show, which was very tepid and modest and not nearly as aggressive as they should have done, the first thing they did was they grandfathered all of this that was in the system. And they said, and they said on their own website, we had grandfather basically means forgive. They forgave all of this fake stock that was in the system at the time the regulation went effective because, in their own words, they feared excessive volatility from large pre-existing open positions. So those are the same large pre-existing open positions they were denying existed shortly before. So they go from saying this isn't a problem to saying, okay, we're going to pass this tepid regulation against it, but we have to forgive everything in the system or else it will crater the system. And now, they're saying, well, the story shifts weekly. You have guys like Jim Chanos, who's a big hedge fund guy, and he's the spokesman for the hedge fund lobbyist, which is called the Managed Funds Association. He was saying a year and a half ago, this isn't going on. Hedge funds get their they borrow stock before they short, so this isn't going on. Then he came out and said, well, it's not our fault. It's the prime broker's fault. The argument since this summer has been the SEC can't we think that they should demand a pre-borrow, which is what they did for the 19 stocks. And what that means is before a short seller sells, he's actually got to pre-borrow. He's got to borrow the stock and then sell it. He shouldn't be able to just sell it and then look around and 3 days later find some stock to borrow, because the truth is that's where the stop comes in. And so now Jim Chanos and the hedge funds, the Managed Funds Association, have come out and saying, oh, this would destroy liquidity in the marketplace. And if they're stopped from doing the thing that they've been denying doing all along, they've been saying, we're not doing this thing. And so we say, great, let's close the loophole on that thing that you're not doing. Let's just close the loophole on that. And they've come back and said, oh, no, this would destroy liquidity in the marketplace. So which is it? They're speaking out of both sides of their mouth all the time. Won't do.
Now, in the wake of the SEC's orders, you published an editorial at Forbes, which you said you had actually written almost 2 years ago, describing this problem. Weren't able to publish it. I think you took it to the Wall Street Journal.
They actually asked me to write it. Someone there asked me to write it. And I wrote it and submitted it. And then they said, we're not going to be able to publish this or anything else you ever write.
Which is indicative of your treatment by the press over the past few years. Do you feel that's changed?
It's changed enormously. I'm running from here to do an interview. Myself or colleagues of mine spend all their time now teaching reporters who are coming up to speed on this. Economists who work for me, guys besides Judd, whom you know well, but economists, lawyers, people like that, just spend all their time now working on data requests made for us by either people in journalism or, there's plenty of people in Congress now too. And it's more like we don't have the staff now to keep up with the requests for teaching them and giving them data and the reports they need.
You mentioned Judd Bagley, a former freelance journalist who now basically works for a company you've set up to do nothing but investigate this problem.
Yeah. Deepcapture.com.
Deepcapture.com, also the name of the company, where you're running a contest of sorts, which I believe is
ends tomorrow
midnight, November 15th, which will probably have passed by the time Reg readers listen to this. But tell us about the contest.
Well, the contest was a fellow from the Columbia Journalism Review, which, as you know, is a very highly regarded journal for reporters and journalists. I think of it as the gold standard of American journalism, but that's not saying much these days. And this fellow got interested in the story. He ended up, while he was at the CJR, his life was threatened. He disappeared, and then he showed up this January and said, I can't go on with my life until I write this story. So he came out and he wrote a 69-page fabulous story, every piece of it true, about this whole fight. And his focus is media criticism and how the New York financial media just let this problem grow right under the nose, wouldn't look at any data or anything, because they've gotten so chummy with a small group of hedge funds, and it looks like those hedge funds are involved in the crime. So basically,
just to be clear here, it seemed ironic to me that he's chummy with you, this journalist. I mean, you're in essence paying him to do this, right?
Well,
I mean, how is that different?
Well, for one thing, it's open and explicit, and I've said I'm starting a company that's just going to do investigative journalism, and I'm going to fund it because investigative journalism is dead in America. Enterprise journalism is dead. You and the Register are rare exceptions. The stories you've written on this issue, I mean, you see what has gone on. That data was there for several years. Even much of the stuff that Judd put together that you sort of studied for a long time before you went and published with it, that data was there for other people to see. But American journalism, probably under budget cuts or it's become so corporatized that enterprise journalism is dead. I get the sense that journalists in most mainstream publications, or especially newspapers, they think their job's sitting there reading press releases, typing it up in their own words, and publishing it. Investigative journalism is dead in this country, and the Register has been a real exception. And you know I'm not saying that just because I'm here. You guys ran with some great stories. So what this is just a company I fund. It's probably going to go on and take on other subjects too after Wall Street. But in particular, I've never been so disappointed in, I think, an American institution as I am now in American journalism, and especially financial journalism, and especially New York-based financial journalism. It's unbelievable. It's the worst. They got so chummy. Now, the rules, there's a lot of evidence that the rules changing, that the editors have woken up to what's happened. But because the New York financial journalist community would not investigate this, I funded a company, and that's all it does is investigative journalism. And how is it different? Well, it's open. We say it right on the front page that I funded this, that I'm behind it. And that's one big way in which it's different.
But as you were saying, Mark Mitchell put together this 40,000-word Joycean piece on the whole naked shorting saga, posted it to deepcapture.com. And with this contest, you were trying to encourage people to read this, right?
To read it and to spread the word about it. And then we built a widget that said, you go and do something to spread the word about this, come and tell us what you did, and then the community votes your entry up and down. And who's ever winning tomorrow night at midnight on November 15th wins. Number one place gets $30,000, number two place gets $20,000, number three gets $10,000, and then there's, I think, $5,000 of smaller prizes. We're going to do this again. We're going to run another one probably up through, I haven't picked the date, but March 1st or March 30th or something. So we're going to have another contest.
And have people successfully gotten the word out? Any creative ways of promoting the piece that you can share?
Oh, sure. People have – there's been a couple hundred contest entries. People have – I see, because often they blind CC me. We put this up at the beginning of May, and naked shorting entered the public discourse within about 2 months. Now, I'm not sure there's a cause and effect, but I do know that people started sending this story or letters about this story to sort of every editor in America. I must have gotten thousands, been copied on hundreds, if not thousands, of emails from people where they started, where they were just sending it to every editor. People made videos. A fellow made a really nice little 10-minute documentary that explains the issue and put it on Current TV. Do you know Current TV?
Sure.
And then it won the weekly election within Current TV, so then it got national play on a cable channel. And anyway, within 2 months of this being up, the whole cover-up of naked shorting had been broken. It had entered the public discourse, probably more from the fact that our financial system was imploding.
Right. But it's undeniable that naked shorting does go on, but it seems to me, however well deep capture spreads the word, it's still debatable how much of an effect it has on the market. Economics in a sense is opaque. I mean, you can argue both sides of this, can't you?
Well, I think the naysayers are gone. I mean, I was just on I debated the SEC economist on CNBC or something a month ago. The whole discourse has changed. In fact, I would say the debate's over. You know, he was on. Everybody admits now it happens. It's pernicious. It has to be stopped.
But what I'm saying is, it's debatable how much an effect it has. So for instance, NPR recently ran a piece on its This American Life program about naked shorting. Quite a good piece. Most of the piece, however, is based on an interview with a former SEC employee. He worked for their enforcement arm, a guy named Jonathan Kaufman. Mm-hmm. So he does a good job of explaining the issue, says there's no denying it goes on, but in the end he says it's not that big of a deal. It's such a small portion of the total trades on Wall Street. It had no effect on the meltdown, is his eventual take.
Well, that's all nuts, but it's still progress. It's, 3 years ago it wasn't going on. Then we'll do something to stop it, but we have to forgive all that it's gone on. Otherwise, that'll crack the system. Just look at – I'm surprised to hear you saying this because I think the whole intellectual debate's over and has been for several months. There's nobody serious anymore maintaining that it is not – that it is not – has not played a role in this collapse. This whole debate. If he said that on NPR, then that's a huge step backwards because that's where the debate was a year ago. But for the last 4 months, I thought that whole meme had died out. There's actually a very and certainly why anyone would listen to somebody from the enforcement arm of the SEC. Let me tell you a quick joke. There's a school of psychology called behaviorism that says, let's forget about internal states. Let's just treat as a black box. No ego, id, superego, all that stuff. We're just going to treat agents as black boxes with inputs, outputs. So the joke is two professors of behavioral psychology have sex. And when they're finished, one says to the other, well, that was good for you. How was it for me? Well, so the point is sometimes academics get in their head this sort of they carry around a theory to the point that they can't even experience what's right in front of them. The modern financial theory is dominated by the capital asset pricing model and by the CAPM. Naked short, you can't manipulate stocks any more than you and I could go to a horse track, go into the betting cage, and we can go into the betting cage and play all the games we want, but it's not going to affect the underlying horse race. Well, that's the basic paradigm from which modern finance professors think. That's been upended to the point I'm surprised to the point that not only is Chris Cox and the SEC commissioners out there saying more or less we were wrong.
But wait, he's not really saying that, right? I mean, he made the order, he cracked down on it, but in making the order, he said it's not that big of an issue. We're just trying to instill confidence in the market, right?
Well, I didn't hear it as – well, I have plenty of quotes from him which are less guarded than that. I debated the the guy who was the SEC chief economist when all of this stuff unfolded, and he went on television and said, and he said just the stuff that I've been saying. He didn't downplay it. I'm surprised, you know, given that now the government has had to take an emergency action to shield off the center of our financial system from naked short selling. If they want to go on TV and say, well, this is all, you know, just to instill confidence, let them. But that's silly. There's no way on Wall. I mean, 3 years ago, people on Wall Street thought I was nuts. I don't know anybody on Wall Street. Everybody I know on Wall Street now gets this, understands it, thinks it's a huge problem, thinks it has to be stopped. I didn't know there was anyone anymore who had questions about that, frankly. But if there are any, it wouldn't surprise me if they're in the SEC enforcement division.
Got it. And, you know, to get back to the media, like you said, the media in your mind has also come around and has seen your point of view. Part of the media's sort of skewed view, you've always said, was Wikipedia, which the Register has written about extensively. The problem has alleviated in large respects over there as well. I mean, your contention is that a former Business Week journalist, a guy named Gary Weiss, who by the way, has always denied this to the Register, was behind multiple accounts on Wikipedia, influencing the Naked Shorting article, the article about you, the article about himself. And that, in a sense, affected the discourse, as you say, influenced journalists across the country. But for those who don't know, since we last spoke on Radio Reg, the Wikipedia accounts in question were banned. That problem seems to have alleviated as well, no?
Right. I didn't care about the article on him or really on me, but the article on naked short selling, he didn't just influence it. He owned it, and he was empowered to own it by this famous Uber administrator, Slim Virgin. And you've written some amazing kind of – you've written some great stories on that. One of the so anyway, I'll stop and let you get to your question if I –
Well, I just wanted to see if you had read the Naked Shorting article on Wikipedia recently, if you're pleased with it.
I go every couple of weeks. It's still heavily slanted. And what's amazing is the discussion page where everybody gets that it's slanted, but also people understand there's some sort of hidden – people have to nudge the article towards the center very carefully. And they're nudging it carefully. But all that said, it's vastly improved. The other side of the story is now told on the Wikipedia page on naked shorting, which has freed, as far as I can tell, some journalists to start writing about it. I'm doing interviews all the time, day after day after day now, with journalists who are coming to understand naked shorting. They're understanding that it's really a one example of a broader class of problems, which is our settlement system. Our settlement system is Swiss cheese in the United States. Anyway, the naked shorting page has definitely made improvements, and I think it's probably no coincidence that, you know, in the last 2 months now, there's all kinds of journalists coming. You know, it takes a couple months to come up to speed on the story, but they're getting there.
You've phrased it quite well in the past before. You know, you've said that. Social media, Web 2.0, is in a sense, and this is a prime example, out in front of its headlights. Mm. Do you still see it that way? I mean, considering all the changes that have happened on Wikipedia, do you still see Wikipedia in particular and maybe social media in general as a huge problem? Could we see a similar scenario? I mean, your story, like so many of your stories, is extreme. But could you see this happening again with other situations?
Oh, I could see it happening again. I love social media. The issue is, just to catch people up, every Wikipedia page has a discussion behind it, has the talk page. And you go and read a page on, you know, who guest starred on Friends or something, and you don't really care what the sources are. But you can go on any page you really care about, a contentious subject, you can go and read the talk page. It turns out there's very lively discussion and there's on the talk pages, and there's rules that are supposed to assure an amalgamation emerges from all that discussion that really does represent the consensus. Well, if the rules were followed, it would be hard to hijack. It would be hard to manipulate the pages on Wikipedia. You could still do it by forming cabals and sock puppeting, and which it turns out people do. But it couldn't. I don't think it would get that bad as long as the rules were enforced. What's happened is on, as you know, I believe you know, on 2 million Wikipedia pages, there's one set of rules, but on a few Wikipedia pages, those rules got suspended, and they were the pages on naked short selling and me and Gary Weiss. So the fact that the rules were suspended, and then any discussion of the suspension, in fact, became verboten and such, that made it much easier to manipulate. But I think that social media in general is really, it's, I think I compared it in one interview to Bam Bam. It's immensely powerful. It doesn't know its own strength, and it's really unguided. I think that what I'd like to see emerge is anonymity is a big problem in social media. It lets people, it encourages all kinds of pernicious behavior. And
right, this isn't just Wikipedia. I mean, you've got, CNN's citizen journalist site posting rumors about heart attacks with Steve Jobs, and Apple's share price immediately plummets. And you're right, anonymity is the problem, and this is a huge problem on Wikipedia. I mean, is there a way to solve that?
Well, we've started a little social media era within Overstock, and our original point was to tie it to make it impossible to be anonymous, because there's so much trolling and clogging and sock puppeting that really just introduces noise into the discourse. I forget what the reason was. We didn't actually end up you still can use handles and such. And the problem isn't just Wikipedia, although Wikipedia is extraordinarily powerful. There's a whole anti-Wikipedia movement that's evolved of people, some of them journalists and scholars, who study certain issues. And it turns out, on any issue you don't care about, Wikipedia is great. Who guest starred on Friends in the 67th episode? It's great. But if you get on any subject where there's a lot of contention, or especially a political subject, there's very clearly organized efforts to manipulate the discourse there. And the reason it may matter more there than it does on CNN is when you Google any subject, you Google the Israeli-Arab debate, the first thing that's going to come up is Wikipedia. There's some technical rules, that's true. It's natural language. It changes quickly. It's catnip to the Google engines, to the Google bots. So there's technical reasons it floats to the top, one assumes. But that also makes those pages extremely powerful. And there's very clearly organized efforts to go and manipulate the discourse you and I and some of our friends, and if we form some sock puppets, we can get on a subject on Wikipedia that is politically contentious, and we can really steer the discourse. And by doing that, presumably you're steering public debate.
There's a good analogy here. Wikipedia, in a sense, is a free market. It's a knowledge free market as opposed to an economic free market. Mm-hmm. The situation is that it needs more regulation, right? Which is exactly what you're calling for in the economy itself.
Well, I certainly have been calling for reform. We need reform, which in some cases means more regulation, in some cases better, and some cases we just need to enforce regulations that have been around 70 years. I'm not saying, the only way you could do that with Wikipedia would be if the government declared it some kind of public utility and it had the right to regulate it. Or the other way it gets, what's scary to me is there's so many stories about how you can't trust Wikipedia, and some 15-year-old kid from Iowa got on and manipulated the story on Martin Luther or something. But that doesn't seem to have sunk. It still is, you see the traffic numbers for Wikipedia. I don't know if anything's going to stop that steamroller. But what it means is it's actually an interesting analogy that the free market, totally unfettered and unsupervised, it can generate some pernicious outcomes.
You'll notice that both Alan Greenspan and Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, are extreme Ayn Rand devotees.
Yeah, that I know that. Although I wish Greenspan, when Waxman had been questioning him, I wish about, you know, doesn't this show something's wrong with your free market models? I wish Greenspan had said, you know, maybe this shows we need better politicians, because I view this subprime mess as clear. I view this as – this is an incredibly regulated part of the credit market. There's actually a federal regulator who does nothing but regulate Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. It's the reason this was not – there were efforts to keep Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae from getting over-leveraged to the point they toppled over, and those efforts were stymied by certain senators and congressmen. It's kind of a replay. It's an amazing replay of what happened in the 1980s with the whole SNL crisis, where people, about the key. I don't want to go into ancient history, but the Keating Five. And
sure.
All that.
So, final question. Now that the naked shorting argument is over, as you say, what do you do with all your time?
I'm going to get a ranch somewhere, 10,000 acres, where I can see them coming from all directions, is what I've been saying.
For the sake of the ranch, I hope that you soon start another crusade that no one believes in, and that this continues for another few years.
Well, I'll probably be around. My big crusade is education. It's funny. 20 years ago, I was involved in development economics, and back then I used to argue that it all came down to getting fair capital markets and good systems of education. I didn't realize 20 years ago that the third world country I'd be fighting for would be my own. But so if we can get the capital market cleaned up, the next task would be fixing the education system. And then there'll be time to check out.
Fair enough. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Cade.